good enough.
That is the motto for this podcast. Good enough.
No, oh. The motto of this podcast and every podcast is
better
the absolute
than your
best.
Be the
That's
best.
That's a little aggressive.
Yeah, it was too aggressive.
I was going to say something like the best podcast we've ever done, ever created by humans.
Good. I like it. I would. That's a good one for a shirt.
Yes, it's a long shirt.
Yeah, it's a good one for it's just for a big shirt. Yeah,
people are taller these days. They have longer shirts. Ben,
Zach,
all of that's going to be in there. By the way,
Definitely the long shirt part. I want to just—it's part of our sort of our ulterior idea for the podcast, which is to get people to just wear like long nightgown shirts, night shirts everywhere.
This has actually just been all a ruse or yes. an entrance. This podcast has been a Trojan horse into our long shirt manufacturing
business. Yeah.
Scheme.
Yeah.
Yes. Business.
Business.
Scheme.
We're so rich.
Not scheme. Business.
No. This is for money. But the podcast is sort of the way we sneak in there.
Gosh, my knees are cold, but I don't want to wear pants.
I know, a very long shirt with long, long blocks of text on it.
A long shirt, you say?
Yes.
Well, that kind of fits in because in more terrible segues, people used to wear long shirts in ye olde days.
When they really properly knew how to do a segue?
Ben, what are we talking about today on The Monster Market?
Episode 2 of The Monster Market is household spirits or house elves, home spirit yeah. creatures, home deities, household deities.
And this is something that I think everyone is familiar with, much like our last episode with mermaids. But it's something that is pretty ubiquitous across cultures. You know, you see similarities wherever you go.
And for me, that's going to be kind of the rolling theme. With our aquatic episode, there were similarities, but there was also a wealth of differences between all these creatures that we talked about. But the similarities and the way that these creatures are similar to me is what was striking to me when I was doing my reading and planning.
Yeah, same here. So should we just get right into
it? Yeah, let's do it.
Listeners may remember that I have my Ewok coin to decide who's going to go first. We have the Duloc Shaman on one side, which I'm calling heads, and the Ewok description on the back, which I'm calling tails. I'm going to go ahead and flip it. Do you want to call it in the air?
Yeah, say flip and then I'll call it.
Okay, ready? And
Duloc
flip.
Shaman. Heads.
Oh, hold on. That went all the way on the
floor. Do you re-roll or do you call it from the floor?
No, I'm saying we call it from the floor, but it is heads.
Yes, I know that the little house spirit in your house wanted me to go first. As soon as that coin was out of your sight, it snuck in and turned it over to heads.
Oof. Can house spirits do that? Can they travel from house to house? Let's find out, shall we?
So, I like how in these, we also end up going on a sort of, we go through a journey to different places in the on the globe as we talk about these different mm-hmm. creatures. I had a really good time visiting Italy and talking about Luca Basla. The creepy well spirit that would pull little children down into the depths. So I'm going to start out back in Italy, right where I left off with Luca Basla, and I'm going to talk about the Folletti. I have loved the idea of the Folletti ever since I started hearing about them, and I even put them into Julia's House for Lost Creatures as a sort of little nod to that time.
And I have to say, this is a creature that I associate with you because I heard about it from you and I know next to nothing about it other than
I've drawn it into these books as a hat with a beard coming out of it and a large nose. I really sort of simplified the design. But what's interesting to me is a lot of this is probably going to sound really familiar. To me, what was striking is the variations on the theme. And you get sort of like a similar creature, but then with that culture's specific flavor put onto this creature. So the Folletti are Italian farm spirits. I first heard about them from my father-in-law, Silvio Bertolini. He was just like, you've got to do a story about this little guy. He's got this red cap, this little beard, this little guy. So I first thought about them as the Folletti as a Folletti or as this one little character. But then when we started going over to Grania, the first, oh gosh, it's probably like 2006 or 2008, then I picked up a book at an old sort of like this like little used book fair down in the piazza, and you could tear through. They had all kinds of interesting stuff, really cool stuff, and a lot of like locally printed books and folk legends and stuff like this. And one of the books I picked up was called La Magia di Folletti. And it was clearly like a local book. And I'm really sad that I wish I had brought it back. It's still in the house there. And I would have like consulted that book in talking about this if I could have. But what was so striking about it was this cover where there's mist. And in the mist, there's an old woman sitting on a stoop. And it's a photograph. But it looks like it could be, it looks like it could be like 300 years ago or something, right? It looks very medieval. And it describes the Folletti as, so they're Italian farm spirits. They look after the farms, but they're not terribly nice. They're very prone to kicking over milk pails, curdling milk, and putting burrs in horses' manes and tangling horses' manes, and they take umbrage very easily if you slight them. But you can sort of buy them off with porridge and little gifts, which is another sort of recurring theme.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So, but the tangling of the horses' manes, like these little tangles in horses' manes, are almost universally called elf locks or fairy locks. Have you heard of this?
Yes. Not specifically with horses, but I did run into that even just for people, like people who wake up with tangles and knots
little
in their
kids
hair.
Yeah, especially. Yeah, so that was interesting. The idea of the Folletti and the stories in this book about the little folk traditions surrounding them, and the pictures in this book, and then also just being up in the mountains in that area, there are so many dusty stone wood cantinas and like so much of its ancient stonework kind of baked in, and like the Etruscan peoples then sort of existing historically underneath pre-Roman people, like there, you can still find evidence of them in these statue stelae, which were these look a little bit like Folletti, slightly, which are these sort of Etruscan monolith way markers, right? And so all this together, like, really sort of enchanted me to the idea of the Folletti as it really still fitting into that area with its old cantinas and chestnut groves and stuff like this.
So you mentioned like the hat and the nose, the red hat, you know, things like that, which, you know, kind of feels like a gnomish kind of thing. But so maybe you're about to get to this, but like, so do they, is that sort of like the typical description of a Folletti?
Yeah, or? It's very similar. It's very similar to the garden gnome, and like so many of these are, right? The red cap is a big one that seems to go through all of these, as is the sort of wizened little look to them with the beard. So many of them are described like that, and then that's interesting to me. There are a couple other commonalities between all of these, which I'm going to get to in the other ones. But there's also this idea of leaving stuff out for them, whether it's a gift or whether you're sort of buying them off for their little extra bit of work that they do, or buying them off so they don't do negative things to you, right? So anyway, I really like the Folletti. I got a real kick out of putting them in Julia's house, having one of them make a little campfire on the roof. We're going to travel north for the next one. I'd kind of hope to travel south because another sort of half memory I had from the same time. So about 2006, I was going over there, and I was traveling down to Florence a lot and trying to do painting, trying to learn painting. And one of the people I met there, one of the teachers at the Cecil Studios, her name was Lynn, and we got to be friends. And she was telling me all these stories of the things that she had done before coming to the Cecil Studios. And one of the things, and you'll imagine my ears perking up at this, was she had traveled around India doing fire shows. So I'm like, oh, really? So they travel around. But I remember her mentioning that her and her this troop that she was traveling around with used to leave bowls of porridge out for the fairies.
What year would was this?
This would be between 2006 and 2008, one of those years.
Okay.
And she would have been doing that probably 2004, 2000, something like this, was maybe when she'd had been traveling around. But I tried to look up to try to find some information about that. Like if there was, I couldn't find anything definite enough to build one of my little reports around. But I'd like to look into that further at some point. Like, I don't know if like it would be like a Hindu tradition or what, but it'd be interesting to look into. So instead, we're going to travel north next.
All right. So, you know, you're talking about traveling and being in Italy and moving north. And the thing is I have one from that region too, but I don't want to talk about that yet. So I think what I'm going to do, I think I'm going to start north and I'm going to come down and meet you.
Okay. We'll pass each other. That'll be fun.
Yeah.
Maybe we can grab a coffee.
The first one that I've got, I think, is a pretty typical broad one, much like how you did mermaids last time. I want to talk about the brownie. So we're up in England. We're actually in the sort of general Anglo-Saxon world. So information that I have found on the brownie. So I don't know if actually, Ben, you want to write this down.
Okay.
1/2 cup butter, 1 cup white sugar, 2 eggs, 1 teaspoon vanilla extract, 1/3 cup of unsweetened cocoa powder, 1/2 cup all-purpose flour, 1/4 teaspoon salt, 1/4 teaspoon baking powder.
What are we making?
Well, that was a recipe for a brownie. So brownies, I think most of us know brownies as, you know, little fairy folk, generally described as being male. The broad typical description of a brownie, which is, you know, a helpful house spirit. There's actually more specific stuff to a brownie. Certain details that I think have gotten lost in kind of more modern depictions, particularly modern depictions that tend to want to beautify everything.
Sure.
So brownies, traditionally, again, in the Anglo-Saxon world, they're originally described as kind of like dark, shaggy creatures, usually dark brown in color. That's where the name brownie comes from. And are also described as being pretty alarming in appearance, ugly or alarming to most people. And because of this, that's why the brownie is super secretive. Right. So like it only comes out at night after everyone has gone to sleep. It's very quiet. It's very secretive. It can actually turn invisible, though it almost never has a need to because it's that quiet. But it comes out because it doesn't want to scare people. It doesn't want to alarm the people in the house. And the thing that the brownie does is the brownie helps keep the house clean and safe. It finishes chores that are left undone. It'll finish sweeping. It'll take care of animals. It'll tend to crops. Scottish brownies, in particular, are described as being very helpful in brewing. Hmm. And Cornish brownies are known to take a special interest in taking care of bees. Now, one of the things I found interesting was that the brownie will often adopt the home or the family itself. So a brownie just sort of like appears.
Okay.
You know, and I was thinking to myself, you know, what happens if someone is just like, well, I didn't sweep the hearth today. Just let the brownie do it. Well, that's one way to piss off a brownie.
Oh, okay.
So a brownie is there. A brownie isn't a slave or a servant, right? A brownie does not do the chores. A brownie helps with the chores. So a brownie kind of watches and takes everything in. Well, you know, they worked really hard, but they weren't able to finish cleaning out the stable. So I'll go finish that.
Okay.
Again, one of the theme of payment or treating this helpful spirit well comes in the form of the brownie only wants one thing, a small bowl of cream and a cake that is smothered in honey.
Okay.
So people would leave this out for the brownie. Some people even had what was called a brownie stone, which is a little rock with a hole in it, and that's where you put the cream.
Neat.
To leave anything but cream or this cake for the brownie is offensive to the brownie. So there's a lot of stories about, say, like a woman discovers a brownie in her barn who's doing all this work. And the brownie is always in rags or naked.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be a very like genuine, good-natured gesture. So like she'll say, oh, you know, I want to thank this brownie for doing all of this work for me. I'm going to make him a really nice set of clothes. And so she does that. The brownie takes offense and leaves forever.
Yes. This is a commonality.
Yeah. Furthermore, if the brownie is ever overhears someone in the house talking about paying the brownie, mm-hmm. or even referring to, say, like the bowl of cream or the honey cake as payment, the brownie will also take offense to this and leave. So those things are always gifts, right?
Yes. It's gift economy. Haha.
Yes. Cool. The brownie is gifting you its labor, and you are gifting him some cream or honey cake. If there is, say, like a large house, like a manor that has servants and the servants are lazy, the brownie will kind of be mischievous with the lazy servants to get them to work. So this kind of furthers the brownie is supplemental help.
Right.
The brownie is not a slave or a servant. Those were things that I didn't quite know or remember about brownies. Again, first of all, the ugliness of their appearance. And secondly, the, like you said, the gift economy of a brownie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this one has a lot of similarities, but in terms of looks, it's wildly divergent.
Mm-hmm.
Except
mm-hmm.
for the smallness. It's like these other ones.
So yeah, so that's what I have to say about the brownie.
So you would think of the brownie as the archetypical creature in this category, like classic mermaid.
Yeah, yes.
Okay.
I sort of feel that way, yeah.
Interesting. Okay, cool. Number three. So we are going to travel quite a ways north and find ourselves in the Netherlands.
Oh, we went way north.
We did, yeah. And we're only going to go north from here. But first I want to tell about how I came to this one. When the girls have ballet practice, I have this spare hour, and in the colder months, I spend it in blue plate books, and I peruse the shelves, and there's all kinds of treasures in blue plate books. I was like, I am going to peruse the mythology section. I'm sure that they'll have something that I'd be interested in there. And I was passing by the Spates catalog and Tobin's Spirit Guide, and then I found this wonderful book, Spirits, Fairies, Leprechauns, and Goblins, an Encyclopedia by Carol Rose. The tagline on the bottom of the book says, "Our favorite work of 1996 offers fascinating explanations of some of the world's most mysterious creatures and spirits." Library Journal. So this is great. It's a good book. It's and it's got all kinds of stuff I wouldn't have found otherwise. And so I was looking, and I want to read this one in full, if you don't mind. It's a very short one, because I found out about the Kabouter Mannequin. Also, it's so very similar that I would call it the same thing as the Dutch Red Cap. And that part of the Kabouter mannequin is one of those words that we find a lot in the fairy tales and the Grimm's tales. Rumpelstiltskin is described in some of the stories as a mannequin. So he's like and it usually means like a magically small person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, any sort of like small, I mean, isn't there even like plant people called mannequins or something?
Yeah, and it comes up with like when you're looking up homunculi and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I'm going to read about this, and it will sound very similar to what we've been talking about. A type of goblin or brownie in the folklore of Holland. This spirit could be naked or hairy, or wear rather old and dusty red clothes and cap, which is why he would sometimes be called Red Cap. This sprite would make work at night in the mills, grinding corn, storing sacks of flour, or resetting the heavy millstones. That's one that comes up a lot, is resetting millstones, mm-hmm. if they'd become worn. All that he would receive for his services would be a slice of bread and butter and a glass of beer. As with all such spirits, a gift of clothes once accepted would ensure that he never worked there again. A miller of Kempnerland, who did not understand this, had given his Kabouter mannequin such a gift, then tried to get the spirit to return by lying in wait at a bridge where he was sure to pass. Just as the goblin saw him, the miller heard what he thought was his wife falling into the water screaming. Running to rescue his wife, the miller realized that he'd been duped, and all the sprites had vanished. So that's that. And I guess the two other things I would say about it are, one, this gift of clothes ending the service. I'm sure everybody has thought by now, oh, that's the house elves from Harry Potter, right? They seem to be a distillation of this whole idea. And the other thing is the red cap. I haven't been able to find any real solid link, but there may be one. But the red cap is so similar to the idea of the fly Garrick mushroom, which looks like a little person with a red spotted cap that I've always imagined. When I've ever heard of the red cap, I've always imagined it like that.
You know, something I'm thinking about is I'm thinking about this idea of red hats and where, like, red hats, the red cap is like not a nice, like,
right.
I mean, that's he's murderous.
Right. And I've read that there's kind of two separate traditions there, but there's that too. And, you know, the other thing I had thought of, which I had meant to mention with the Folletti, was that it seems like there tends to be like a core myth or a core idea that is very widely disseminated amongst different cultures. And then each culture, right, will sort of, it gets garbled evolutions, which I think is one of the things that keeps us interested in folklore, is that it's like this sort of ever-changing thing, like we talked about with gremlins, right? But one interesting thing with the red hat, especially that conical red cap that keeps popping up in different places, is, you know, when I was thinking about the Folletti, it's actually also very similar to like the way Pinocchio is depicted always with, it's just really similar. He's like, especially in that area when you find the little Pinocchio dolls there, that it has that, he has that conical red hat, not the Disney version, but the little wooden versions that you can buy in Italy. Right. He's always got that little hat.
Well, and like, I mean, I even was thinking about, I don't, if you remember, and if astute listeners remember, when I talked about the Merrow last time, and they're described as having red hats.
Right.
Red
they help
hoods.
Them breathe underwater.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's something about that. There's something there that it recurs time after time. And that would be something that would be a really interesting topic to dig into.
So you mentioned a book when you were talking about your house spirit from Holland there.
Mm-hmm.
I have a book that I want to talk about too. And this is a book where I found a lot of the information specifically on the brownie that I just talked about. It's got a very dry title, of English Myths and Traditions by Henry Bett. My copy is from the 50s. What attracted me to it was it's got just beautiful pen and ink illustrations by a man called Michael Ayrton. You know, his drawings in here are really great. The book really does a good job of sort of presenting this folklore and traditions from England, but then also analyzing them in a folkloric kind of way.
Okay.
So if you can find a copy of this book, I think, like I said, it's an old book, but I think I got it online and I think I maybe paid $12 for it. So it's not like some super rare, expensive volume, but the illustrations alone are just really, really wonderful.
That's cool.
Okay. So my next one, I'm coming down to meet you, I guess. But not that far.
Oh, okay.
So I'm still on specifically the Anglo-Scottish border.
Okay.
And something that I discovered while reading is you see a lot of these creatures described as border fairies or border goblins. And it's specifically talking about that region between like England and Scotland. So this is the Kilmulis.
Ooh.
I don't know if you've heard of this.
No.
So the Kilmulis follows this same house spirit pattern of it is a small creature. It helps with the chores. It is kept happy by giving small amounts of food, but can also turn mischievous and malevolent if it's abused or treated poorly. The details that are laid on top of the Kilmulis, though, that make it stand out is it is specific to mills and helping the miller and the kind of work that is done around there. The Kilmulis does not like to leave the mill, but it will if it needs to. Mm-hmm. If a Kilmulis has been treated particularly well and, you know, the miller says, go down to the farm and help my wife churn butter or whatever, the Kilmulis will huff, but he'll do it. But he doesn't, he's kind of a homebody. He doesn't like to leave the mill. The word sounds kind of weird. An old word for the front of a hearth or a fireplace was called the killigee.
Oh, is it could be related to kiln as well.
Yes.
Interesting. Yep.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hearths and kilns. Yeah. Yeah. So that's where it likes to live. It likes to live there. There are stories of millers finding little footprints in the ashes in front of the hearth, things like that. They'll actually leave a little spot, like a little bed for it to sleep under the kiln. Now, the most distinguishing feature, however, is the Kilmulis has no mouth.
Ooh.
And it only has one huge nose, or snout. That's it. But the Kilmulis loves to eat. And it is also described that it has a particular taste for pork. And so the miller will leave food out for it, particularly pork, and it eats it by shoving it up its nose.
That is fantastic.
It's delicious. Yes. They can talk, though, apparently. They will talk to the miller and stuff like that. So I don't know if they're just talking through their nostrils or what. I don't know. But these guys can turn particularly malevolent, again, if they're abused. That's always one of the things, too, is it's like if they're offended or if they're abused, like if they're made to do all these tasks and not, there's no reciprocity.
Right.
And so there are stories about them like taking a whole season's harvest and throwing it over the edge of a cliff, things like that. You know, letting the animals out at night to escape. So you want to keep this guy happy and just keep his nose and his belly full.
Which is like, it's again, it's the domestic economy, it's the gift economy, right? It's like, this isn't a business. He's part of this place. We're helping each other.
Yeah, he's like one of those birds, right? That live on like rhinos and stuff.
Right. Sure.
they get safety and they eat the bugs off. Yeah, but it is weird, and I find myself as I was reading this and sort of thinking about what these fairy tales and what this folkloric tradition, how it speaks to things like servitude and slavery, and trying to find what is kind of the mental, psychological, cultural, like how do those connect?
Yeah. Well, it's also like a lot of these seem similar or springing from like the hearth gods, right? Like these, they're like creaturely versions of Roman hearth gods or earlier, you know, gods of the kiln or fireplace, whatever it is. And unlike somebody's like, who's a, you know, a soldier who's in the employ, right? There are other jobs that you do in the world that you do for pay, but the stuff that happens around the home, it tends to have a different sort of system of payment and balances and stuff. I don't know.
It's definitely, you can see it as, or I see it as kind of this, it kind of occupies the area between sort of like a straight up like symbiotic relationship and, like you said, employ.
But it's also got this layer of like, if you do this, I will be offended. That kind of speaks to hospitality, like rules of hospitality, these unspoken rules.
Right. And also none of these house spirits. So like, you know, even like with the brownies, where the idea is that the brownie adopts the family, adopts the home. And so all of these house spirits seem to be there of their own volition, at least in what I was reading. Like, you don't necessarily see stories about them being captured or imprisoned and like made to work. Cause like you said, it's as simple as offending one of them. They leave.
Yeah. Well, the next one we're going to talk about, I've got a little something about, you know, the mill or the family or whatever it is, but a lot of these are tied to the place. So it's like, they come with the property, right?
Right, yeah.
And they're long-lived. The family may live and die and change or be replaced by somebody else, but they're still there on, you know, part of the farm.
Really quick, there was a story about a family that abused their brownie, and the brownie became terrible. And so the family was like, we can't take this anymore. We're moving. And so they packed up their wagon and they moved. And the story goes that while they're on their way, someone stops, one of their neighbors stops and is like, oh, you're moving? And they're like, yeah, we can't handle it. We can't take it with this brownie anymore. So we're moving. And then the brownie pops up out of their wagon, is like, yep, we're moving.
So like, nice. I guess we've passed each other. I'm going to imagine that we had our coffee somewhere in, I don't know, somewhere in northwestern continental Europe, maybe.
Sure.
Maybe on a boat.
With some pork from the Kilmulis.
With some yummy pork.
Nose pork.
Some nose pork. So I am going to go with, this is, to me, this is my, for you it seemed to be the brownie, for me this is my iconic one, and it's the Tomten. We're in Sweden now. Tomten or Nissa. To me, it's also the reverse side of the Folletti. These are, they're very similar looking with the beard and the big nose and the tall conical knit red hat, more commonly tied to a place. And they're much warmer and much nicer and more protective than the Folletti. They are also in the Swedish tradition seems to have really held on to this tightly. And it's now in the Tomtens now associated with Christmas as well. I also think IKEA's Christmas gnome. That's the Tomten. So they really have held on to it as a part of their culture. And my first experience with the Tomten was with Astrid Lindgren's books. We know Astrid Lindgren from Pippi Longstocking, and I know you and I both love Ronja the Robber's Daughter. Mm-hmm. There are two other books of hers. They're picture books, and they're gorgeous. And one is called The Tomten, and one is called The Tomten and the Fox. And they're the most wonderful, quiet, haunting depictions of one of these little creatures that I've ever come across. And it's really what gave me the feel of this kind of farm spirit. They're quiet stories. In the Tomten and the Fox, I think it's guiding a fox through the farm on a snowy winter night. But it goes and checks on all the things in the farm, right? And it'll talk to the fox in a quiet little language that a fox could understand. And it's beautiful illustrations of the moonlight. The illustrator is Harold Weiberg. So yeah, these illustrations from the Tomten books, they have that John Bauer kind of ethereal, otherworldly fairy troll look to them, with the large nose and the close set eyes that are bright. So I really, really loved the Tomten. And it really wormed its way into my brain because I read these books to the kids. What's interesting is that it keeps popping up. Now the girls are very interested in, very much enjoying the Hilda books. Mm-hmm. And in Hilda, they've got Tontu and Nissa. And these are kind of the same creatures. That's my experience with the Tomten. But then I looked it up in this book that I'm gaga for right now, Spirits, Fairies, Leprechauns, and Goblins, an encyclopedia. There's just this one line when it talks about Tomtar, Tomte, Tomte Gloob, Goob, Gooba. But I'm going to read this very short section because it has an idea in it that has not left me any peace. These are the little people in the folklore of Sweden. They were thought to be the previous race of people displaced from the land when the Vikings invaded. Like the Tuatha De Danann, they inhabited the ancient forts, cromlechs, and other earthworks. They were skilled in magic, the making of tools, and other crafts. The Tomtar harassed the humans who had invaded the land and were generally very malicious. People eventually learned how to appropriate the Tomtar by leaving small gifts, for which they would do farm and domestic work during the night. Eventually, each farm had its guardian Tomtar, which brought good luck and prosperity. They are said to resemble the Nissa of Denmark, but are much smaller and slower. Like them, they enjoy a bowl of porridge and some bread and tobacco, but only on Christmas morning. To give the Tomtar any better gift during the year, of course, as we know now, would be sure to offend him and he would do no more work. But this idea that they are...
But it's like ubiquitous.
It is. It's ubiquitous across all of these. But this idea that they are a previous type of being that was living in the land, and then the mention of the ones which are basically Tolkien's elves, right? Mm-hmm. The Tuatha. It's an idea that's really wormed its way into my brain. This specific creature with the beard and the nose and the red cap, the sort of dynamic of working for not for pay but for gifts, or you know, like this gift economy between the, it seems so ubiquitous through all these cultures. And then on top of that, the idea that they were these previously existing creatures that were there before the people were. That seems to be just like a really preternatural kind of idea baked into civilization, people.
Well, two things collective I'm thinking of too,
yeah,
is how much that sounds like the, or more modern depiction of a gnome. You know, when you think about the, you know, that book Gnomes, and you think about David the Gnome, and again, this idea, like you said, small beards, forest, you know, red hats, but also, you know, kind of tending to like the forest and the wildlife as mm-hmm. well. And the thing is, like, that view of gnomes, I know this isn't the gnome show, but
but it's close. The garden gnome is such a similar thing that it mm-hmm. it almost feels lumped in. It's like it's The garden is also the, it's not inside and it's not the big world. It's a border creature, right?
Right, right. But I guess what I'm also thinking of is that, you know, I know that that depiction of a gnome is fairly, you know, all things considered, modern, because originally gnomes were one of the four, you know, like in Norse mythology, you had the four elemental spirits.
Right.
And gnomes were the spirits of the earth.
Yeah.
They weren't necessarily little dwarfish creatures.
No, more like Lewis's gnomes in Bism.
The other thing that where my mind just went, you know, talking about like a previous race of humans, you know, thinking about how much of that is a racial memory from when there were different types of humans.
Yeah.
Living together.
Yeah.
or at least existing in the same time period.
Yeah.
You know, obviously most of us know about, you know, Homo sapiens and Neanderthals, but
there were others.
Yeah, you know, you're always hearing about like them finding ancient pygmy races and things like that in the Amazon and stuff like that. So
sure.
Folklore and these creatures and these monsters don't come out of whole cloth. They come from somewhere that is ancient and forgotten.
Right. And there are recurring themes in it that keep getting remixed and revisited. And it's, I don't know, it's one of the most interesting things about it.
So my last one here, we've definitely stuck to Europe for this one.
Yeah.
I think that's okay. But I'm now going south and now I'm in Italy.
Ships that pass in the night.
Yes. Everyone's like, oh, did you see Ben? He just walked that way. And I was like, yeah, we had coffee and nose pork. So you may know actually more about this or something about this. And so please jump in. But sure. I'm talking about the ancient Roman Lares.
I know nothing about the Lares. You enlighten me. This is going to be great.
So the Lares, now that's it's Latin. So a single one would be a lar. Some of the sources I read said that they were pronounced Larrys.
Nice. Yes.
Let me tell you all about these Larrys.
Specifically translates as something funny for us. Yeah.
Lares are so ubiquitous in the ancient Roman world, and yet there's not a lot of specificity pinned onto them. So what a lare is, or what a lar is they are a spirit of the home. They don't necessarily do chores, although sometimes they are kind of described as doing that. It's seen more as just sort of like a general luck and good fortune kind of spirit and protector. Okay. Of the home. However, not just the home, but I'll get to that in a second. So they do have some of the same characteristics in that the Lares in the home are expected to be treated well. Often there is a ritual of throwing a little bit of food in the fire for them. They are prayed to at any kind of special marker, you know, a special event, even like the beginning of the week, things like that. They'll pray to the Lares for good fortune. A lot of ancient Rome, it seems like they were thought of as being spirits of the dead.
Okay.
So like dead relatives, but not necessarily. I couldn't really find a lot of information as to whether or not they were specific spirits. So in other words, if it was specifically like, oh, this is the spirit of our grandfather, every source that I went to just kind of described it as a general spirit of the family's deceased.
Okay.
Roman houses would actually have something in there called a lararium.
Oh.
And it's a little altar with one or two little statues in there. And that's what the family would pray to. And it was, you know, it was in almost like every Roman home.
Okay.
So this was like a big, and certainly we see that in more modern times when you think of people of, you know, Spanish origin and things like that, having little shrines and mm-hmm. altars. So definitely, you know, coming. I had mentioned that these were spirits of the home, but the Romans had, it's sort of like the next step removed from an animistic religion.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was like, again, it's like the Etruscans, you know, you mentioned pre-Roman times being very animistic, and a lot of that still translated into Roman society. So the idea that every rock, every table, every door had a spirit.
Yeah.
The Lares, so everything, almost everything had its own Lares. So you have Lares of the house protecting the family, but you also had Lares protecting roads and crossroads and walls and gates and all that kind of stuff. And you would actually, at crossroads, there would be little shrines to the Lares there, usually with little dolls like hanging from them that people could go and pray to. Something I thought was interesting. So as I said, where it's sort of like the exact origin and nature of these is pretty vague, because while they're often thought of as being like spirits of the dead and there's, you know, homes have little shrines and stuff to them. There's also a myth about a nymph named Lara. Who, or Larunde, she's got several different names.
So could it be where our name Lara comes from? Maybe?
I mean, I suppose it could be. But so the myth about her is that she had her tongue cut out because she revealed Jupiter's infidelities.
Okay.
So she was punished by having her tongue cut out. And Mercury was escorting her to the underworld. And in the process, they got it on. And Lara gave birth to twins who were mute. And these twins are considered like the first Lares. You have that connection with the underworld, with the realm of the dead. But it's still, like I said, it's vague, and it's also, a lot of this depends on what point in Roman history you're talking about.
Sure.
Because you can see how much this evolves. But the mainstay is that everything has a Lare protecting it, and especially the Lares of the home, you want to pray to them, you want to treat them well. You know, basically anyone who didn't acknowledge or treat their Lares well could never expect any good fortune.
This is interesting, and it kind of also almost ties into that idea of muses and geniuses, which would be fun, a whole fun topic of its own.
Yeah.
But it seems, because it's also like, that's just, you know, folkloric tradition, but it's also just so much a human behavior, right?
Yeah.
Because I like that idea of like, oh, everything has its spirit. And however you think about that, it's also just a human behavior to kind of like take it outside of yourself, right? I don't know. Yeah.
So I found this quote too, which I found interesting, which I found funny. So like I said, so Lares in Rome were ubiquitous. And in the 3rd century, the Lares were often sometimes cited as a reason that a pagan Roman should think twice about taking a Christian wife.
Oh, interesting.
Because the quote says that the Christian woman would undoubtedly be, quote, tormented by the vapor of incense each time the demons are honored, each solemn festivity in honor of the emperors, each beginning of the year, each beginning of the month.
Huh.
So this idea of like, don't take a Christian wife because she's going to get annoyed at how much you have to pray to the Lord.
How much
she's not going to like all the incense.
He's not going to like all this religion.
Yeah.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah, I found that to be a funny little tidbit. And again, and you know, showing that changeover from
That's also an interesting point where things flip flopped, because now the incense is associated with certain parts of Christianity, right?
Sure, sure.
But in the early days of Christianity, it was like, no, I will not give a pinch of incense to this god.
Yep.
And then those gods sort of, you know, mostly died away out of culture and left the incense.
Exactly.
That's pretty fantastic.
Yeah. Oh, and then the other thing was, adjacent to the Lares, there was another type called the Pentates.
Okay.
And a lot of times they were specific to like public buildings or like borders where like one family's land met up to another family's land. Sometimes they would put a rock or a little shrine there to be like, this is where the Lare hangs out.
Neat.
But like, it's funny to think about spirits or protectors of concepts, right? Like a concept of like a border.
Yeah.
Versus a concept of a physical object.
Yeah,
I mean, I guess a border can be a physical object, like if you put a wall on it.
But we still have, you know, Justice with her scales and Lady Liberty on our shores, and like, we do have characters that embody conceptual ideas.
Yeah.
But not quite like the border. That's
yeah, because those one. Conceptual ideas, justice and liberty, like those are big concepts, big, right?
Yeah. But not like this is the border between like, yeah.
Yeah.
This or, small or like, province, this neighborhood in that neighborhood.
A spirit that guards the space in between.
Mm-hmm. They're markers.
Right. And it can kind of bend your brain a little bit, a modern sure. brain to try to kind of.
Well, that's why it's like, it, well, yeah, well, whether it's a belief or a behavior or, you know, what the line is between belief and behavior is kind of an interesting concept.
Right. Or where that even comes from. Like at what point sure. did somebody, at some point, someone was the first person to say, hey, there's a spirit that is guarding the imaginary line between this thing and that thing.
Yeah. But it's also completely natural. It doesn't even need to have a first person to say it. It just sort of, these things, like, I don't know. I remember like walking to school with Denver every day, and we got into such a routine that there were like certain, it was almost a ritual, right? The walk home. We had to do all these things exactly the same.
Yeah.
You're right. Jump up and slap the stop sign. And then there was a bush that we would pass and pretend to sneeze and blow all the leaves off of. But we had to go through each step, you know? And that was one tiny step removed from, you know, appeasing the spirit of that bush.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
give it a couple
right.
more years and we'd be doing that.
Yeah.
So yeah, very natural.
All right, so that was our House Spirits show. So Ben, last time we each picked a favorite from the others.
Oh yeah.
So you went first, so I think you should have to pick first.
Honestly, I'm going to pick the Larrys, the Bad Larrys.
The Bad Larrys.
Oh, it's hard. It's hard to pick between the Bad Larrys and eating pork through your nostrils. Those are two. Bad Larry and nose pork are two. Concepts that brought me a lot of joy, mm-hmm. I would say. But I am going to go with Bad Larry's because it was the most diverse conceptually mm-hmm. and led me to some interesting thoughts.
It kind of makes me want to have a Larry in my house, you know?
Like, yeah.
Well, I think a little statue. And...
You should make a little statue. I don't know. I love the idea of house altars. I would put my Flatwoods Monster up there.
Yeah. Yep. Something that's interesting too, if you look up the Larry statues, they're almost always have like one arm, one hand raised.
Uh-huh.
As though it's making a conduit between, you know, like the heavens and
their connectors.
The prime material.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So let's see. So of your three,
there's the Folletti, the Tompton.
I mean, I like the Folletti.
What was it called again? The mannequin, the Kenevan a mannequin. Kabouter yes. mannequin.
Kabouter mannequin.
Yeah.
So for me, it's between the Folletti and the Tompton.
Okay.
I think I have to go with the Tompton just because, like you said, I am also enamored/haunted by this idea of they were a previous race that lived in the fields, in the forests until the Vikings came.
Yeah.
I love that concept.
And even more haunting to think that, like, to take that concept, like to take a grain of how maybe deeply embedded that concept is and how it's so strongly still there, you know, well, we see it with the IKEA Christmas gnome, like it's still there, mm-hmm. right? Like it's still there and kind of strongly. That's great. Story fodder, I guess I would call it, a deep rich well.
And overall, we talked about it already. We touched on it a million times, but the things that are the same with all of these,
yeah,
that it is a voluntary gift economy,
domestic arrangement hat. That you make.
Yeah. With a red hat.
Yeah.
That you can easily offend.
Yeah.
So I guess maybe there's something there that's kind of like, it's almost like, if you've got a good thing going, don't question it too much.
Yeah. Just keep putting that porridge out.
Just keep putting that porridge out and don't.
Don't think about it. Just keep putting that porridge out. Don't think. It's simple. A little cream, a little porridge. Fine. Put in a little hole.
Put in a little, you know, some honey on the cake is fine. I'll sweep the hearth. Sweep it.
Put on your long shirt.
Put on your long shirt.
All right. Well, this was, as always, a joy. I find myself like re-energized in my, you know, thoughts about story and mythology and folklore and stuff every time we talk.
And I can't wait to see your depictions of these creatures again, especially like when you've got creatures that have very similar
variation on theme creatures.
How do you differentiate?
Yeah, that's going to be a fun challenge.
All right. Well, for Ben Hatke, I'm Zach Giolongo.
And for Zach Giolongo, I remain Ben Hatke.
And we're going to wear our long shirts and we will see you next time.
See you on the beach.
Hey, everyone. David Universe here, producer and audio engineer for Ben and Zach's Monster Market. On behalf of the team, thanks for listening. Music for this episode was created by Twinstrumental. If you'd like to see sketches of the creatures discussed on this episode, as well as other mystical goodness, please find us on Twitter at MonsterMarket00, as well as Instagram and Facebook at MonsterMarketPod. For creature recommendations, or just to say hello, please email us at MonsterMarketPodcast@gmail.com. And don't forget, subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. Until next time, beware, because they be monsters out there.
So did you not like my brownie recipe joke?
I was like, oh, is this a recipe? I was like so serious. I was like, oh, is this a recipe for what you leave out for them? And I was like, that's obvious, most obvious joke. And it was like, when it actually went over my head. I'm humbled by how clueless I am. I was like strapping in for this folkloric journey, and you started saying this thing, and I was like, this is it. This is the recipe for what you leave for these creatures.
This is how I get a brownie into my house.
I'm sorry. My mind was in another place.
Well, I wasn't wrong. That is how you get a brownie in your house. A whole tray of them.
Even if you're somebody like me who's only interested in the corners.